Culture Crossover, where I talk about the Indian pop culture news that's worth hearing about. Over the next hour, I'll be chatting with you on current issues within the sphere of Hollywood. I've got a couple stories on jokes and pranks. It's only appropriate now that it's April, which is possibly my favorite month because the Bay Area starts to warm up, but there's still some rainy days, so it's all full of surprises, which is all the better when you're trying to dig up interesting stories for all of you. So get settled and let's have a chat. In our first segment today, All in the Gray, I will be talking about, first, the CEO who stepped down from Mozilla this last week. So following his appointment just over a week ago, Mozilla Chief Executive Officer Brendan Eich has stepped down after controversies emerged over his financial support of anti-gay marriage bill Proposition 8 in California. The move comes after popular internet dating service OkCupid discouraged its users from accessing the website through Mozilla browser Firefox due to Eich's stance. In 2008, Eich donated $1,000 to a lobby group who supported Proposition 8, a California bill which sought to remove the rights of same-sex couples to marry, a bill which has since been squashed by the Supreme Court. With the tech industry being largely left-leaning, Eich's views came as somewhat of a shock to Mozilla board members. But his appointment to CEO still went ahead regardless, seemingly unaware of the increased scrutiny personal views like these receive once an individual is elevated to a figurehead position. Mozilla released a statement over Eich stepping down, which contained a swath of "we really should have seen this coming" statements, such as "Mozilla prides itself on being held to a different standard, and this past week we didn't live up to it. We know why people are hurt and angry, and they are right. It's because we haven't stayed true to ourselves, and Mozilla believes both in equality and freedom of speech. Equality is necessary for meaningful speech, and when you need free speech to fight for equality. Figuring out how to stand for both at the same time can be hard." Eich, for his part, expressed how his skewed personal beliefs fitted in with Mozilla's vocally pro-LGBT rights stance in The Guardian early this week, stringing the following diverse beliefs, including on things like marriage equality. We couldn't have done this. We couldn't have done Firefox 1. I would have been excluded. Someone else would have been excluded because of me. I wouldn't have done that personally. They just have left. So imagine a world without Firefox. Not good. He then continued down the path to a sort of weird, obscure viewpoint, dragging Indonesia's cultural views on the next into the mix, and as an example of why he should remain in charge. LGBT marriage is not considered universal human rights yet, and maybe they will be, but that's in the future. Right now, we're in a world where we have to be global to have effect. So it's sort of weird how Eich has took that stance and tried to, you know, kind of explain himself, and bringing Indonesia into that was super kind of weird for me because all of that is so opposite of how America is really coming to feel about everything. And Mozilla is a huge company for Americans and everything because they have done so much in regards to our businesses of the internet and everything. So the article that I read, it ended with saying, "Moral relativism might help Eich sleep at night, but for a company that's already put its food down on the issue, it's an untenable position." So I thought that was a really, really good way to wrap things up with the whole story about Eich, because as much as we like to think that moral backgrounds and everything doesn't have that much of an effect anymore and that it's not really relevant or anything, it is still pretty relevant, and it can cause people who are appointed CEO, who are business people and everything, to lose their jobs or to back away from certain positions and everything just because they do hold such a really great meaning behind it and everything. And so my next story comes from a comment from Kirsten Dunst, and she is one of Hollywood's biggest icons, and she's one of, like, the most, she's just the perfect lady all around, and that's how people view her. She's just so perfect. She's been in the public eye for as long as, her career has been, which I think since the age of 3, she appeared in her first film. And so she's really, really well known throughout the world. And Kirsten Dunst is somewhat of a Hollywood fixture. And with her next film, The Two Faces of January, due in theaters later this month, Dunst covers the May issue of Harper's Bazaar UK, looking ethereal and positively radiant. Too bad the only part her interview to get any attention is rather controversial thoughts on relationships. In a time when celebrities wave around the F word, feminism, like a trendy accessory, and women are encouraged to lean in and fight the good and fight for equality, the 31-year-old star tells Bazaar, "I feel like the feminine has been a little undervalued. While we all have to get our own jobs and make our own money, but staying at home, nurturing, being the mother, cooking, it's a valuable thing my mother created. And sometimes you need your knight in shining armor. I'm sorry, you need a man to be a man and a woman to be a woman. That's why relationships work." Beacon of feminism Jezebel called the actress kind of dumb, while the beauty site The Gloss called her interview messed up. Plenty of hetero couples reverse the old roles and have a woman breadwinner and main caregiver, and plenty others choose to split both roles down the middle. Haley Hoover wrote at The Gloss, "Dunst has made a comment that not everybody's comfortable with, because she is saying, look guys, I think that most of us are kind of, we're fighting too much to have our own independence, and because we've had such a tradition for so long, we're trying to rebel against it, but that doesn't make it wrong." And so I think what she was really just trying to say is bring a point to the other side, because so many people fight for women to be independent and be on their own and not need a man to make them happy or, you know, express the every part of a gender role to a T and exactly that. And because there are relationships now where, you know, there's a man and a man or a woman and a woman, and they're homosexual relationships rather than heterosexual, yeah, those are different. And I don't know if she was exactly commenting on that, but I think that she was just getting a lot more criticism than she deserved. Relationships don't have to be a certain way to work, and when you use your public platform to preach old school values as absolute law, you're making it harder for people outside the traditional norm to live their lives in peace. Though unclear if she practices what she preaches, Dunst is not sitting around idly waiting for her night. She's been dating her on-the-road co-star Garrett Hedlund since 2012. In an interview with Details magazine in February 2013, Hedlund revealed just how he courted the blonde beauty. "I took her out on a 3 a.m. canoe ride," he said. "It was not a stable canoe. We fell out and we had to swim back in mucky, shitty water, like golf pond water." Kirsten Dunst is a new cover for Harper's Bazaar, and so she is going to create influence in everything from what her statements are, because, you know, you buy these magazines and you digest what they say and everything, and yeah, her point will be probably taken by some women in a positive way, but also in a negative way, and that's okay, because, you know, she's just kind of bringing to the table a different idea than what is normal. And for this next segment, I thought was kind of interesting, was April Fool's was last week, and there was a little special on Complex website about some shows that had pulled April Fool pranks in a way, and it's just how, like, their storylines were really inconsistent or something like that. So as one example, Sheldon from The Big Bang Theory, he is considered a walking contradiction. Though John Parsons has collected tons of hardware for his performance as Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory, the character has one of the least consistent biographies on television. His character totally mutates based on the needs of a joke at hand. Sheldon makes sarcastic remarks, but yet doesn't understand sarcasm. It is mentioned that he is allergic to cats, but he bought 25 cats after a bad breakup. He claims that he hates physical contact, but is then seen hugging and even cuddling with other characters. In season 3, Sheldon claims he doesn't dance, but in the next season, he is an excellent dancer. There are more, but listing them all would be about as exhausting as watching The Big Bang Theory. So that's a funny one, just because it is a sitcom, and so sitcoms normally are pretty inconsistent because they just kind of go by what is going on in the show and that segment, and it's a short show, and you know, whatever can get the most laughs is usually the best part. And the next show that I was going to talk about is Lost. So the geography of Lost Island might be its strangest secret for some Lost fans, which are still tearing their hair out trying to figure out the solutions to all the show's mysteries. We'll leave all the spoilery, mystical secrets of the series alone for now and just talk about the boring old geography. Throughout the series, the layout of the remote island changes to fit whatever plot being advanced at the time. In the season 4's confirmed dead, Sawyer says that the barracks are due south, even though the survivors have set up camp on the southern end of the island. Near the coast, in season 6, The Substitute, Alana's group comes from the northwest end of the island. Later in season 6, Black Rock is on the opposite side of the island in Dr. Linus in Exodus Part 2. So Lost was a show that was very gripping, and it had a really cool storyline, but no one could ever figure out what that storyline exactly was. And so I don't know exactly what was so enticing about it. Maybe it was just the characters were really dynamic, but just the storyline altogether was you got lost very easily and everything like that. But I watched that show. I started watching it, and I ended up finishing it in a couple of months after I started watching it on Netflix. I did some Netflix marathon watching for that show, and I thought it was really good, but I can see why after so many seasons and so many years of it on TV and like waiting for the next episode and watching in real time would have been extremely frustrating. So for my next little show is Walking Dead. Walking Dead's super popular, except it's also one of those shows that has a lot of inconsistencies with it. So there are clear Walking Dead zombie rules until there aren't. Before the premiere of The Walking Dead, AMC laid out some official rules for how their brand of zombie would behave. Given their revolving door of showrunners, working in what could easily become a pretty repetitive environment, it's pretty predictable that several of these rules were eventually violated. There have been numerous examples pointed out by diehard Walking Dead fans, but one of the most glaring is zombies have poor eyesight, but they do have a strong sense of smell. Given this rule, it seemed ridiculous that in season 1's guts, Rick and Glenn could just slather themselves with zombie intestines to avoid being smelled out by the walkers. In the season 2 premiere, the gang ducks underneath cars without rubbing themselves in zombie parts, and they still avoid detection. It's a safe bet that the minds behind the highly rated show aren't too worried about these inconsistencies, because at the end of the day, it is a show about zombies, and you know, whatever you're doing, you're not really, whatever you're doing while you're watching the show, you're not really exactly trying to point out, oh, I remember in the episode prior to this where this happened or that happened. And, you know, just paying attention to the little details in that is not really going to get anyone anywhere. So those are my couple of stories that I picked, or the couple of shows that I picked out of that story that was on Complex. And I know that there's a ton of other shows out there that are exactly like that. But what I wanted to go to really quickly before I break is a story about Anderson Cooper. So he's talked about his child modeling days before, but Recently, he opened up about the disturbing experience that led him to quit. Cooper started modeling at age 10 and worked for Ford Models. Earlier this week, he sat down with Howard Stern, who asked him why he stopped at age 13. "I got propositioned by a photographer, a male," Cooper recalled. "He somehow got my number and called me up and offered me money, and it so freaked me out. I never told anyone. I just stopped. I was like, forget it." At that point, you were obviously aware that you were gay. "But it wasn't like you wanted to be with an adult man," Stern continued. "Yeah, I was 13 years old. I wasn't even thinking about sex with anybody," Cooper said. When asked if he thought the photographer knew he was gay, he said, "I don't know. I don't think he had any idea. You know, maybe he did. I honestly don't know. I think he saw that I was on my own, that I didn't have a parent or guardian there." His comments began at the 8 o'clock mark in the clip that is posted online, and he shared his thoughts about Alec Baldwin and discussed his career in the same interview. So hearing that about Anderson Cooper, it's really sad because you wouldn't think that someone who is so in the public eye has been subjected to that kind of torture and everything and all that, but it's out there all the time. It happens every day, and it's really sad, but it's just something that is a part of our culture and that no one ever really wants to discuss openly. But I think that it's really cool that Anderson Cooper has decided to put that on himself, to tell his own story and everything like that, and not be afraid to tell everyone the truth. So we're going to take a short break, and I will be back afterwards, and we'll talk a little bit more. This is DJ Synergy, and you're listening to Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. Welcome back, everybody. This is DJ Synergy on my show Culture Crossover. You're listening to Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu. And we are just coming back from our first break of the show. I was just talking to all of you about a couple things. So first off, we were talking about Ike, the CEO who stepped down of Mozilla Firefox this last week. He had only been appointed for about a week, but he had negative views about gay marriage, and he thought that it wasn't appropriate for him to still stay on for a company that was so pro-gay marriage. A couple other things we're talking about. Kirsten Dunst and her views about feminism, which I thought was pretty interesting because you wouldn't expect people to take such a drastic viewpoint and say, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I don't think that being a feminist is the right way to live life. And I think that being a feminine woman is perfectly okay. And, you know, just in the age that we're at, that's not really the viewpoint that the majority of women or even men have, I think. And so that was interesting. But now we are going into the second segment, Drowning in the Mainstream. And I have a little story about a hipster. You know, his name, you might know him, Dom of Bondi. And what he did was he posed for a photo shoot that resembled exactly Miranda Kerr and her photo spread. And so, listen in, let's chat about this. So, Dom of Bondi appears sans substantial levels of clothing in a tasteful shoot paying homage to the ever lightly misted Miranda Kerr as seen in the most recent GQ magazine. But this time, it's not the shoot that's worth talking about. It's the interview. So, on romance, I need a woman in the bedroom. However, some nice comfy boobs to lie on. On the NSW or Not Safe for Work Transport Club, Mile High Club, put it this way, I've had a wink on a bus. So this is the kind of just story tell all of Dom of Bondi, and his actual name is, well, let's figure that out. I don't know where I lost my place. So what happens in the whole photo spread was he posed nude and he was just sort of going for the whole I don't accept gender role kind of feel. And so in a Facebook post that is quickly going viral, a group of artists called Bondi Hipsters have recreated model Miranda Kerr's recent British GQ shoot and rewritten some of the model's quotes about masturbation, bisexuality, and sexual expression as if it were a male subject. Model Dominator, that was his name, Dom of Bondi, his name is Dominator, recreated some of Kerr's coquettish poses, pulling down a vest top over his crotch and down his chest and curling up seductively on a mat for pictures taken by Pat Stevenson and Adrian Archer, who was also the creative director of the shoot. Look, let's be honest, the polar ice caps are melting, and I just want a ticket on the secret Illuminati spaceship that the 1% are going to fly away in. I don't have anything else to offer except my hairy chest and focused gaze. Nader joked to HuffPost UK. It's important for people to understand the masculine form can be just as beautiful as the feminine form. Why can't men appreciate other men? Why can't men talk about masturbating on public transport? And Adrian Archer, more seriously, the shoot lays bare the stark difference between the way men and women are portrayed in glossy shoots, and the questions asked of them by interviewees. Kerr revealed in her interview that she appreciates both men and women when questioned about her sexuality. I want to explore never say never, she said. We thought it would be interesting to reshoot Miranda Kerr's recent UK GQ shoot using a man as the subject, Bondi hipsters Christian Van Vieren told HuffPost UK. With this, we want to requote some of the things that she said in her GQ interview. But coming from the perspective of a male, as you can see, the shoot comes across very differently. We think that this is a good case for the over-sexualization of the female body in the high fashion world. For some reason, as soon as you put a man in there and have a man talking about same-sex curiosity and masturbation, it's an entirely different thing that we aren't used to seeing in the media. And so this came across to me, this story came across to me on pedestrian.tv, and you can look it up. Dom of Bondi Hipsters talks bisexuality. And it's just, it's an interesting perspective to take on because, you know, I have talked on the show before about how they have taken men and completely copied the way that women are portrayed in advertising and, you know, like in fast food commercials with them eating a hamburger on top of a wet car as they wash it or something, you know, and you put a man in that situation, he looks like a fool. And so I think that the Dominator put this, his own self, and he kind of sacrificed a bit of him in order to really show the world how ridiculous we all are for, you know, saying that women can talk about this, but men keep quiet about that and everything like that. And so it was really interesting to hear that story and see the photos. You should really look it up. They're pretty interesting and, you know, highly sexualized and everything. And, you know, he has no shame towards that, and he shouldn't. I don't think that anyone really should have shame for showing off their body in a classy way. For my next story, it is on the artist-filmmaker Steve Gerard, who is up and coming, and I just have a couple little interesting stuff going on about him. So many artists have tried to depict the creative process, but few have rendered it as vividly as experimental filmmaker Steve Gerard. Multi-talented artist Steve Gerard is best known for his unsparing and grotesque drawings, many of which function as incisive critiques for both himself and the world at large. They work because even in the depths of their graphic imagery, they are relatable, humorous, and intensely personal. Gerard brings this aesthetic to his new short film, Wad Op. It's spelled W-A-W-D space capital A-H-P, which both vividly depicts the creative process and features a decapitated rapper having sex with his own severed neck. Over the protestations of his meticulously cornrowed and beaded head, the film, which Gerard also stars in, moves effortlessly between live action and animation, devolving from a music video into a hallucinogenic nightmare, complete with a seahorse shooting swastikas out of its eyes. While some internet commenters have dismissed it as the embodiment of shock value, others, including several prominent film festivals, have found something deeper in Gerard's sewer of strangeness. The film recently won both the Anarchy Shorts competition at Slam Dance Film Festival and the Midnight Shorts competition at South by Southwest. But Gerard is just relieved to have finally completed a project whose interminability caused it to rebel violently against itself as it stretched past 2 years. I don't like Mulan, I don't like Wallace and Gromit, but I don't like the Cider House rules either. I can't do These Are Humans with our feelings. I want to keep playing around with reality. I wanted to make an animation music video, Gerard says when describing the origins of his film. I emailed Wu-Tang Clan, Robbie Hancock, Radiohead, everybody. I googled Radiohead email address, got a bunch of hits, and emailed them all. The only people that replied were a pair of British brothers whose slow descent into obscurity had begun a decade earlier, about the time Coldplay started getting buzz. After receiving the go-ahead, Gerard packed his bags and moved from New York to his sister's house in Montana for 4 months, hoping to storyboard the video. Though his part of the process went smoothly, when Gerard returned to the city and began to animate, the project slowed to a crawl. One day he looked up and 2 years had passed. Why am I animating a minute of this funk song? He thought. He couldn't come up with a satisfactory answer. This shit is way too much work to be just an animation, he convinced himself. At this point in my life, I want to rap in the mirror. While growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, Gerard used to rap in his friend's jerry-rigged closet studio. And while he admits he wasn't particularly talented, he remembers those amateur sessions as being some of the most fun he's ever had. With his animation project imploding, he needed fun. But this music video had sucked up so much of Gerard's life. already that it couldn't just be that. He had to slice open his alter ego's throat and watch his own blood drip down the drain into a subterranean layer of malformed cartoons. Animation is boring, he confides. You go a little nutty because of the repetition. Gerard says his only goal at that time was to finish the film and make it a firecracker. He ended up spending more on clay and supplies than he made in that year, but he eventually had finished the project. Though the film has provoked uniformly strong reactions from audiences, Gerard says he didn't think about all that at all when he let his creation loose into the world. He used to fastidiously maintain a Tumblr blog of his artwork, which gained him substantial following, but also led to increasing anxiety. I got really into people's feedback, he admits. I'd scroll through the blog and try to figure out about who I was that way. I started to trying to impersonate the feeling of fuck everyone. I was trying to feed what I thought there was an appetite for. Part of the reason Gerard moves away from his blog was because the constant interaction with fans caused the enterprise to lose its fun, and he's in no hurry to drag the same feeling into filmmaking. Even so, he's happy it had elicited reactions. He says he'd only be upset if people were bored by it or didn't care at all. So, Gerard, he has this totally explicit way of living, and I thought it was really edgy of him to explain himself in such harsh words and everything, and how he was really true to himself, though, and especially with how he had put his content out on Tumblr into the world, and that he got stuck, and he had this creative process that I think without the internet and all the feedback that he was getting, he wouldn't have been so driven off course. But because people, you know, you want to be liked and you want to be as best as you can when you're being critiqued by strangers and everything, and it can be really, really nerve-wracking to put your stuff out and not get good feedback. And so I totally commend him for his viewpoint and everything, and I think that it's cool that he's now gaining success for doing something that he totally loved and completely is, he's putting his heart and soul out into the world. And so I look forward, I'm gonna probably look into his movie that's up and coming. And so for those that missed it, it's Steve Gerard, and he's an upcoming filmmaker, and his new short film is called Wad Op. It's WAWD AHP. And so you should probably look into that if you're into indie stuff and all that. The next little story, it's a short one, but it's about Game of Thrones. And this last weekend, someone put up a video, and it was kind of surrounded by the question of, have you ever wondered what Game of Thrones would be like as a classic sitcom? Well, someone has done that. Apparently, IO9 was so pumped for the return of the series on Sunday that they asked Garrison Dean to splice together opening credits for the show if it happened to be a 70s or 80s sitcom. And of course, it's perfect. Seriously, this is a must watch, and I think that they should really get the ground running on, you know, Game of Thrones, that 70s show style, because it did look pretty interesting in it. It was just so funny because it was this cheesy little opening of all the opening credits and all the characters that are included in Game of Thrones, and had the laugh track appropriately included in on that. Next story is the launch of YouTube's music service, or I guess the delayed launch, I should say, because it is being pushed back over design disputes, according to a new report. The paid streaming service was due to debut earlier this year, but it is being delayed because Google executives want to get it right from the beginning. Billboard cited an unnamed Google exec who said that those involved in the project feel that there's just too much scrutiny of this product and that they need to get it right out of the gate. Indeed, the service, which is designed to capitalize on YouTube's massive existing audience, will enter an already saturated market and will struggle to differentiate itself from established services such as Spotify, Pandora, and RDO. Beyond Design, Google, which has reportedly already secured licenses for the streaming service, is working out how it will be able to convince users to shell out $5 to $10 per month for the service when they have already grown accustomed to streaming music for free. I think it's pretty, I want to say, like, inappropriate, or just, I don't know why exactly YouTube would want to charge us for the streaming service that they're going to be offering, but hopefully this delayed launch will be worth it, and that it blows everyone's minds, because it is a Google product, and so we should have high expectations for it, but, you know, they should have high expectations for themselves, and they, I think, should find a way around the charge fee for the use of the service in order to have the utmost success. But if it's something that they really think is worth being paid for, it, you know, people will definitely join the whole bandwagon behind it, because people still are into iTunes and everything. I know that. I know that I always have Pandora streaming, though, and I much prefer using Pandora. I don't know why I would ever, you know, opt to pay money to listen to music, because I just don't think that that's necessary. In other news, I have one more story in regards to this whole thing, but I think we'll have to come back after the break for it, because it is time for a station break. So this is DJ Synergy on Culture Crossover, and I will speak to all of you shortly. This is DJ Synergy, and I am back from our short break. And the story that I wanted to tell you right before we went on to break was about normcore. So, this is the latest trend of all the hipsters, and I'm just going to talk really quickly about it. Because, yeah, it belongs in our mainstream, or drowning in the mainstream segment, but it's also sort of a viral reality segment as well, because it is creating such a strong following behind it. So this is a fashion movement, and it was created this year, 2014, in which scruffy young urbanites swear off the tired street style cliches of the last decade: skinny jeans, wallet chains, flannel shirts, in favor of a less ironic but still pretty ironic embrace of bland suburban anti-fashion attire. A socio-cultural concept from 2013 having nothing to do with fashion that concerns hipster types learning to get over themselves, sometimes even enough to enjoy mainstream pleasures like football along with the rest of the crowd. 3, an internet meme that turned into a massive in-joke that the news media keeps falling for. A little more than a month ago, the word normcore spread like a brush fire across the fashionable corners of the internet, giving name to a supposed style trend where dressing like a tourist, non-ironic sweatshirts, right sneakers, and Jerry Seinfeld-like dad jeans is the ultimate fashion statement. As widely interpreted, normcore was a mall chic for people, mostly the downtown Brooklyn creative crowd, who would not be caught dead in a shopping mall. Forget Martin Van Buren mutton chops. The way to stand out on the streets of Bushwick in 2014, apparently, is in a pair of Gap cargo shorts and a Coors Light t-shirt along with a Nike golf hat. I thought that was a really funny story, and it's on Times Magazine, so you know it's real. And I was just laughing to myself that such a mundane wardrobe is now becoming the biggest trend among urbanites. Next up for the virality segment is the much disputed story about a woman who was photoshopped in a bikini. You know, there's just sometimes in the world there are huge Photoshop failures, and this happened about 2 weeks ago to this woman, and she is really funny. Her name is Tanya Marie Keller, and she, I can't remember what exact store that put it up. I think it was a Target ad, actually. Yeah, it was for Target swimsuits, and they had elongated her arms in such a weird, creepy way that they were super thin and hit, like, almost at the knee. I mean, when you put your arms down, they hit about mid-thigh, and that's where the farthest that they'll go. So it was weird that her arms, just the arm was already throwing everyone off, but then they had this weird white square chunk cut out of her bottom area. And so a lot of people have been, you know, laughing that off and everything, but it is really serious that people think that it is appropriate to be photoshopping women in such a false fashion. And so Ellen DeGeneres appropriately invited Tanya onto her show. And, you know, if there's anyone who could make light of a terrible Photoshop fail, it's definitely Ellen DeGeneres. Our favorite selfie coordinator, who back at the Oscars, you know, she took the selfie with, you know, Meryl Streep and all of those actors and actresses. She reminded us just how ridiculous that Target swimsuit ad from last month was on her talk show Wednesday. You know, the one with the crotch cut out and the arms reaching past the model's knees, just as I was explaining earlier. So DeGeneres decided to give the model a chance to explain just how much the photo was actually retouched. But when Tanya Marie Keller hit the stage, there was something a bit long about her. It took the audience no time to realize that she was actually wearing Barbie-esque arm extensions. Keller was a sport about the whole thing, placing her awkwardly long arms on Ellen's chair and hilariously attempting to take a sip of water. Of course, the underlying issue is that the Photoshop fails are happening in the first place. But this lighthearted spoof on the matter is refreshing and perhaps can send a message to the retailers that these unrealistic retouch jobs are just not okay. I completely agree and stand behind exactly what Ellen was trying to prove. You know, I think it's a good thing to be lighthearted about the whole entire incident, but at the same time, it's really important that our girls are not growing up in a world, and boys too, that, you know, we have to live in one direct spectrum, and you have to be this weight and this height and this skin color in order to be considered beautiful. And if you look at Tanya Marie Keller, she's a beautiful woman, and she's completely thin, and, you know, she has great hair, and I just thought she was beautiful as she was, and I don't understand why the Target ad would have stretched her so much and done so much work on her. I mean, I guess maybe it was a practical joke, and, you know, Now, they just took it, they just had accidentally printed it or something like that. But anyways, I really hope that everyone kind of just got to realize how serious it all is now, that there are incidences now where women are being subjected to living in one direct measure. And up next is a little bit more of a serious story because, yeah, that was serious, but what really is getting to all of us is same-sex marriage and, you know, racial acceptance and everything, because there's still discrimination out there. And so this was the exact example that I have been wanting to bring forth to my whole show. And Honey Made put out an ad. It was an advertisement that showcased all sorts of couples, ranging from two gay men to a white woman and a black father, and they had children, and there's total backlash to it. So listen up. An international food and beverage company is taking aim at negative reaction to its advertisement about acceptance by attempting to spread the ad's message even further. Mondelez International, formerly known as Kraft Foods, launched an ad campaign called This Is Wholesome in March. The campaign promoted Honeymade graham crackers and Teddy Grahams with the words, "No matter how things change, what makes us wholesome never will." Mondelez created 15 and 30 second spots that featured biracial and gay couples with their families. "Today we celebrate all families," the company wrote. "From working moms to two moms, staying at home to stay-at-home dads to single dads, adopted kids to surrogate kids, Honey Made recognizes that the reality of family has changed. But the wholesome connections that all families share will endure." A couple of conservative organizations did not find anything wholesome about the ad. The group 1 Million Moms wrote on its website, "Nabisco should be ashamed of themselves for their latest Honey Made and Teddy Graham cracker commercial where they attempt to normalize sin." The American Decency Association was also not happy about the ad, writing, "It's not a matter of acceptance, it's a matter of an evil agenda which is being pushed upon America and around the world. Satan continues to attack God's design and skew it to his own workings, evoking thoughts of Satan was probably not on executives' minds when the campaign was created." But instead of keeping quiet through the uproar, Honey Made did something positive. And this is a part of the story that I totally love, because what they did is they printed out all of the hateful comments that had been said along with the video on YouTube. And two artists were recruited for it, and they took all of these papers, rolled them up, and created the sign, and it says love. And it was beautiful. I loved it. But then the video goes on to say, "But the best part was all of the positive messages were received, over 10 times as many," the video states, proving that the only thing that really matters when it comes to family. With that, the video shows the full image of what the artist created. All the comments arranged to spell the word love. Honey Made's latest video was uploaded on Thursday last week and has been viewed about 500,000 times. The post has also received over 10,000 likes compared to 400 dislikes. And so the video stops about halfway and it has the love. And then they take all the positive comments, print those out, and just fill the entire room and fill around love with all the positive comments. And it was just kind of, it was at first you were like, "Oh, I'm so angry that there's all of these negative comments around this commercial. Why are so many people so in such an uproar about it?" But then you look back and you say, "Oh, there are people that are completely accepting of everything, and we just don't pay attention to those positive comments when there are such harsh negative comments." And I think that's true for everything. I think that when you are trying to do something, and, you know, let's say I'm trying to publish a paper and you have one person read that paper and you say, "Oh, this is awful, like, you're never going to get this published." but then you have five other people who are completely behind your project and are willing to support you, but you don't want to listen to the positivity. You only remember the negativity and everything like that. And so I just thought that that was a great, great example of not only the more involvement of biracial couples and same-sex marriages and same-sex couples, I mean, but it's also a great set of proof that there are people out there that are willing to knock down great social structure that's happened in our country. But it's also the people that aren't noticed, the positive people who are willing to accept change, they are still out there too. And it's a great message for, I think, just everything in general. Up next for my story is about Anna Kendrick, and she was on SNL this last Saturday, and she was such a hoot. I love Anna Kendrick. I think that even her Twitter, I end up cracking up when I go through it. She is such a hilarious individual, and she's a great comedian, and I love that she was on the show. And one of my favorite segments was from the part where she is dressed up as Little Mermaid, which I love Little Mermaid, and she is one of my biggest role models in my life because, you know, Disney princess, and I just love the whole story behind Little Mermaid. But two nights ago, Saturday Night Live, it should have just been called The Musical, I think, considering the number of sketches that featured host Anna Kendrick singing her ass off. However, no bit has been talked about more than Kendrick's little Iggy Azalea teaser. If you missed that magical moment, check out the actress rapping to Azalea's Fancy, as well as her Kesha, Selena Gomez, and Britney Spears impersonations. I think that Anna Kendrick is just so talented, and I think that it's just to see her on Saturday Night Live really rekindled my appreciation for her, because she is such a great actress at heart. And before we go, I was just going to talk to all of you a little bit more about normcore, because we do have a lot to say about it. And the first thing that I wanted to bring up was that there are a couple of stars who have been rounded up to represent what normcore is all about. And one of them was Jerry Seinfeld. You know, he has his collared red shirt and his total dad jeans and all of that sorts. And I think that this normcore is really going to blow up. And I think that it can be a total viral movement and probably will be something that is only short lasting. But Jerry Seinfeld is one of them. The next up is Steve Jobs, who satirically, he was the Seinfeld of the boardroom. His mock turtleneck is a normcore must-have. You know, Steve Jobs, he had his shirt, and he was so iconic in wearing that, and just his whole dark jeans and everything. He was a really great representation of normcore. And then we have Obama himself. So thanks to fashion blogs, we've heard more about his dad jeans than his energy policy, which I totally chuckled to that when I read that, because I think that Obama is more taken into his personal life and taken more seriously for that side than what his whole policies are about. And I mean, I don't think that is part of a successful presidency, but I think that it also is sort of setting in stone the next generation of presidents. And I think that that is how we are going to be responding with our presidents, because we have such a more personal way of interacting with them. Also, we can't forget about Liz Lemon of 30 Rock, who is played by Tina Fey, because her frumpiness helped carry the sitcom for 7 seasons. We cannot forget Adam Sandler in this, because his track pants, hoodies, and Yankee hats are the style embodiment of a normcore wardrobe. James Blake, the English crooner, dresses like a walking laundry hamper. Suddenly, that seems like a good thing. And so that was all of the main Hall of Fame normcore people that I thought that was pretty interesting to talk about. And I just wanted to thank all of you for joining me on my show today, Culture Crossover. We had a lot of fun, I think, because I really wanted to capture the whole funniness and pranks and all that to go with the start of April, because unfortunately I couldn't do a show on April Fool's Day, but this is one of my favorite months. It is just, I love pulling pranks throughout the whole month. I think that it should just be April Fool's year, because I don't think that all of us really go and take life with a pinch of salt sometimes. I think a lot of people are a little bit too serious sometimes, and so April, I think, reminds us that, hey, summer's almost here. You're still going to get beat down by a couple rain showers, but it's something that we can all get beyond and live through. So I will bid all of you goodbye, and we will all talk next week on Culture Crossover from 3 to 4. This is DJ Synergy. Thanks all for listening, and I will see you all next week. This is Penguin Radio on radio.dominican.edu.